Hello, everyone. It is Wednesday, March 8th, and you are listening to CITR's weekly news radio show, Against the Current. CITR is a campus and community radio station based on UBC's Point Grey campus. We're located on the unceded ancestral and traditional territories of the Musqueam people. Now, usually we broadcast our episodes every Tuesday at noon and then rebroadcast them every Saturday at noon, but this week we have a bit of an exception. My name is Jasmine. I am your host for today's episode, and today I'll be taking you through a couple different interviews we have about the AMS elections here at UBC, and also a bit of a recap from one of our speakers for the TEDx UBC conference last weekend. So, the first segment that we'll have today is an interview with the Bike Kitchen based at UBC about why they are asking for a fee increase for as part of the AMS election referenda items. Then we'll be launching into an interview with Linda Lee, one of the TEDx UBC 2023 conference's speakers last weekend, about what her experience has been like. Then we'll be wrapping up today's episode with an interview from an anonymous representative of the Trans Coalition here at UBC about why they think students should vote yes to increase and expand the AMS health and dental plan coverage to include gender-affirming care, and how being able to access this care affects trans students, and how not being able to access this care can have a detrimental effect on them as well. Okay, so we'll be launching right into our first interview for today's episode. We spoke with Maggie Marthinson, a junior mechanic at the bike shop, who was campaigning on behalf of the shop about why they think that voting for this referenda item is both important for the bike shop but also beneficial for the community as a whole. And in tandem with Maggie, we also spoke with Alex Alvarez, who is the shop manager at the bike shop, to clarify some of the operational aspects. Okay, so can you first start by telling me a bit about yourself and your involvement in the Bike Kitchen?
My name is Alex. I'm the shop manager here at the Bike Kitchen. I have been involved since about 2016, and I oversee kind of the day-to-day operations as people come in and fix their bikes.
And I'm Maggie. I work as a junior shop assistant, or no, I work as a junior mechanic. I got hired as a shop assistant on Work Learn last year in May, so I've been here for almost a year. And I'm learning to work on bikes, and that's my thing.
Okay, thank you. And can you start off by telling me a bit more about the referenda item for this year for the Bike Kitchen?
Yeah, so this year we're asking for a $3 increase to student tuition fee, and that's an increase from $1.17 to $4.17. In order for us to have more funding for our programs, and also to pay our staff a living wage, and to keep our prices accessible.
Absolutely. And I know I've read in the UBC article that talked a little bit more about this item that you've accumulated some debt since the start of the pandemic. Can you tell me a bit more about how that has affected the shop's operations?
Yeah, for sure. So our financial woes kind of really hit a fever pitch when we were forced to shut down for almost 4 months at the kind of beginning of the pandemic. So from about mid-March to early-ish July, we were effectively locked out of the building, could not operate, despite being declared an essential service, which definitely made life challenging. And retaining staff during a closure and receiving items, it was all a tricky time. And then we spent the next year basically with no clientele, as students and staff and faculty were primarily remotely learning and working. So we had to pay our staff and keep the shop open while really not having anyone to work for. And then currently our biggest challenge is, I would say, retaining staff while not being able to pay market wages, let's call it, and stay competitive in that realm. So the line we're trying to balance is keeping prices affordable for our core clientele of students, staff, and faculty, while simultaneously being able to retain our staff and also, buy bike parts so we have things to fix bikes, of course.
Absolutely. And I know you mentioned that the $3 fee increase would go towards different kinds of programs. Can you tell me a bit more about the programs that the funding would go towards?
Absolutely. So one of the biggest programs that we want to put more time and energy into is our Bikes for BIPOC program, which is relatively new. So right now we've been refurbishing them mostly with volunteer effort. And so these are donated bikes, donated parts that we're putting together and raffling them off. I think we've given away two at this point. They're specifically for Black, Indigenous peoples and people of color that are students on campus, because we understand that the cycling community has not been the most accessible place, and we want to be an avenue for accessibility, especially on campus and in city. And so we're trying to make these sorts of things more reachable to students. And so Bikes for BIPOC would be helpful for that. We've got lots of other programs. We've also got like volunteer nights in which people can learn more about bikes. They can take them apart. And that's, again, where they put them together even. And we're also hoping to bring back our instructional time. I think it's called Mechanics 101. We would be able to bring that back with more funding. Additionally, we've also got programs nights where we have instructional time for free. Usually in the shop, we charge $12 an hour for instructional time on our DIY stands. But during access nights, we've got two. There's a Pride night, and there's also a women and trans night.
I see. Are there any other ways you're trying to make bikes a bit more accessible, or biking a bit more accessible for students?
Yeah. We also do repair clinics around campus where folks will come out and we'll do, hang out for 2 or 3 hours, do minor repairs, adjustments, meet the people, tell them about the services we offer, and yeah, try to, get people involved with the various things we do. Any other thoughts?
We also have Kids Bike Library in the summer, which is a great program. So kids grow out of bikes really fast, and obviously parents understand that. So it can be difficult to get your kid a bike that fits them every summer. So our bike library is essentially you can sort of check in and check out a bike when your kid sort of grows out of it. And I think those go up to something like 24-inch wheel size. So goes up to only a certain extent, but we've got programs like that to make sure that kids have the ability to be on bikes as long as possible as well.
I see. Those definitely sound like interesting programs. Another thing that I was curious about is, do you think that there are any misconceptions around the student population about what the Bike Kitchen does that you would like to address?
Well, I think one of the funniest misconceptions is that we are like a coffee shop or that we do food. I know I've told a lot of people and they're like, oh, you work at a cafe. No, unfortunately, we don't. But let's see, misconceptions. I'm not sure.
I would say our most visible thing is the storefront where people come in and fix their bikes. And since the onset of the pandemic, we've had to pivot to being a service oriented shop, meaning we, people pay us for the repairs, they leave, they go to work, and then come back and pick up their fixed up bike. Pre-pandemic, that was never our focus, and it was never intended to be the goal of the organization. We've just been doing that to stay afloat because doing repairs makes us money. What we would love to pivot back to is the goal of teaching people about, fixing bikes, learning new skills. So I would say a misconception is that we're like a normal bike shop because that's the main thing people see. But behind the scenes, as we've kind of discussed, we have a lot of things going on with charitable programs, giving bikes away. One other low visibility program that we operate is called BC Libre, which is a program where we refurbish bicycles and provide them to temporary foreign workers kind of in the Fraser Valley area. Those folks typically do not have access to transportation other than like a weekly trip to the grocery store. So giving them bicycles allows them the autonomy and accessibility to go, do leisurely rides, of course, but to run errands that they need to do. So it's tough to discuss because it's so far away geographically, but it's a vulnerable population that not a lot of people are paying attention to. So, we try to be very social justice minded, accessibility minded. We also have been doing some repairs on wheelchairs, mobility aids, and strollers. And so these are things we want to expand and learn more about ourselves and train our staff to do more of these things and also have the parts ready to rock if we can do that. So yeah, not just a normal bike shop. We do a whole lot of other stuff for the community. And we also spend a lot of time teaching people about, like, you know, here's how to be safe. Here's what you need to know about being out in the world. It's not just a cash in hand and here you go. It's we try to create a community space where people can learn more about what we do.
Absolutely. And along that disability stream that you mentioned, are there any ways that you're trying to make biking more accessible for people with disabilities?
Yeah, I would say in terms of adjusting bikes, we just had someone this week who we set them up a few months ago with a one-legged pedal situation just because they were having an issue with their other knee. And so they spent a few months just pedaling with one leg and were able to get by and came by saying their other knee's all healed up. And so they were able to, you know, gain full mobility. And for other folks, we do kind of modifications where you might set up the bike to only operate with one hand. So if they don't have use of both hands, there's a lot of stuff we do. We, I don't know, have custom fabricated weird parts and things, or we'll source, you know, a brake lever that might pull two brakes at once with one hand. So whatever, everyone's needs are going to be different. So we have a pretty clever team that can put together all sorts of solutions for folks. And yeah, specifically cyclists with disabilities. Yeah, we occasionally get, you know, the kind of cargo bikes, electric bikes, the whole slew of things, tricycles. It's a bit tricky with our non-accessible entrance to work on these larger bikes, but it's a thing we're very cognizant of and want to be able to address and attend to for sure.
Well, that does definitely sound like a great way to adjust to those different kind of needs. I think that about covers most of the questions I had for you today, but is there anything else that you wanted to share about what the Bike Kitchen does or why you think students should vote yes to the referenda item?
One of the things is that it is an opt-out fee. So students are able to opt out of this fee if they don't feel like they're going to use these services. We love being available to people on campus, even people who don't bike. We like to be, like we said, lots of times we're open, accessible, and we want to be an avenue for people to start enjoying this type of stuff. I didn't really know much about bikes before I started working here. I was really grateful to get this work learn position. And we have lots of that kind of stuff. So even if you don't like bikes, there's still a good reason to vote yes. And if you still don't feel like you're going to use our services, you are completely free to opt out.
Okay.
I would add to that that even if folks are not, you know, cycling, we like to say that, you know, more bikes on the road will equate to less cars on the road, more seats on the bus, less traffic congestion, less parking congestion. So, you know, we like to think that the community will benefit as a whole, in addition to all the other nice things about, you know, recycling, reusing, meeting all those ecological, environmental things. We do, I think, a lot as far as inclusivity for our access nights. We hire a very diverse pool of folks, and anyone can come and volunteer with us regardless of their background. So yeah, even if you don't ride a bike, people on campus will still benefit.
All right, so that about wraps up our interview with the Bike Kitchen about why they think that voting yes to the referenda item can be both beneficial for students and the student community as a whole, but also why it is so important for the Bike Kitchen itself to be able to have that increased funding in order to support their programming. Now we'll be launching into a short break before we proceed with our next interview, but please stay tuned because we'll be talking to Linda Lee, a speaker for last weekend's TEDxUBC conference, who spoke about language justice, specifically in the healthcare setting. So, see you after the break.
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial, open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
you want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing healthcare, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to CITR's weekly news radio show, Against the Current. For our next segment for today's episode, we'll be speaking to Linda Lee, a speaker for last weekend's TEDxUBC conference, about what went into her talk, how it's impacted her, and why she thinks UBC students should give applying to next year's conference a try.
So I talked about language justice and health equity. So language justice is an individual's fundamental language right to communicate, to be understood, and to understand language in the language they feel most articulate and powerful in. And language justice is so important in healthcare because language barriers really compromise one's fundamental autonomy to receive the quality of healthcare they deserve. And, you know, research shows that people who face language barriers in healthcare, people who have low English language proficiency, do suffer from more diagnostic delays and poorer health and quality of life. So language justice is so important in the healthcare setting. I think knowledge translation is so valuable and important to me, and being able to know that public speaking is a knowledge translation tool, being able to tap into that tool is definitely a skill, and it's like research. It's a definitely valuable skill to have. So I hope to like be able to do more public speaking in the future, as much as I feel like it's easier every single time. The inspiration behind my talk was this organization I founded called Valentia Healthcare Translation, where I co-founded the organization around 2 years ago with my co-founder, Rhea Verdi, and it's a nonprofit organization providing free healthcare translation services for immigrants and newcomers all across Greater Vancouver. We've built a team of 30 student volunteers, UBC student volunteers actually, who are bilingual. And currently we offer translation services in Mandarin, Korean, Punjabi, Hindi, and Farsi. So I think it came down to my background as the daughter of immigrants and being raised, facing language barriers in healthcare. My mother actually had a medical background in gastroenterology in China, and I just vividly remember nights when I was younger of immigrants coming over and confiding in us about their medical symptoms and how do I say this in English? How do I really communicate my symptoms to my doctor? So my mother actually used a Chinese to English dictionary to be able to translate their symptoms, their concerns, their worries for physicians to gain a greater understanding of the medical problems and issues they're facing. So I grew up in that environment, and our home really became a gathering place where newcomers and immigrants sought advice and support for all things healthcare.
In preparation for her talk, Linda created a feedback form that was distributed to the people who were using this service, and she got to know a bit more about their experience and decided to include those experiences in her TEDx talk.
After kind of receiving that feedback, I rolled out a survey to all those we've helped at Valentia, asking about their experience with using our services and any suggestions or feedback. And prior to that, we didn't have a feedback form, but from the feedback form, we've gotten a lot of responses, and it was honestly, it brought like tears to my eyes reading the quotes and reading the stories and feedback of other people, of you know, the patients we've helped. And I was able to insert some of that, those quotes into my TED presentation. So yeah, I owe a great deal of the talk towards the people we've helped and towards their stories and their trust, actually, you know, their trust giving their experience and their stories for me to be able to tell is, I'm so grateful for that.
I also asked Linda what other topics and ideas she wants to explore in the future.
I would definitely talk more about our journey as immigrants, the stories of immigrants. I think that I talked about statistics in my talk, but I think that ultimately, you know, statistics can only say so much, but what brings, you know, color and what brings a lot of depth into these statistics or stories.
We also asked Linda what preparing for the talk looked like for her and what her relationship with public speaking was like prior to applying and then in the midst of preparing for her TEDx talk.
I've always had a perpetual fear of public speaking, as I feel like a lot of people do, but I myself especially so. I think in high school, when we used to do like presentations, I would just like shake, and it would be really hard for me to do public speaking. So I think it came with a lot of practice, and even like my time in university, being able to get involved in research, being able to present at research conferences, has really you know, pushed myself and, you know, to the deep end, and having to face that fear of public speaking. I think it came down to a lot of practice. Being able to practice in front of friends and family was so like valuable to me, and I'm so thankful to, you know, everyone who I've practiced with and gave me such great feedback. Like, feedback is super important, and just being able to have people who can listen to you and give you really good feedback is super valuable.
Linda also told her about what her experience was in building community with the other speakers and in supporting each other in preparation for their own respective talks.
It was so energizing and inspiring. I loved talking with, hearing the presentations of other fellow peers and being able to see that same passion they have towards their talk as I did mine. And, you know, being able to hear from such a variety of disciplines, from finding yourself and being able to find yourself towards, you know, things like diets and food and pharmacology. So I loved, you know, that multidisciplinary perspective on things. And, you know, we all bring our passion and knowledge and life experience. And that was just so rewarding. I feel like, I'm like, yeah, you guys are my people, as much as we're different. No one's in kin. But I really resonated with all their journeys.
And finally, we asked Linda if there was any advice that she wanted to offer people who are interested in doing TED Talks or who want to get a little bit more experience in public speaking, and what words of advice or encouragement she had to offer.
I think there's two pieces. So the first, the more technical side of the talk, is saying slower is faster, taking breaks, being able to pace yourself through a talk is super important, because it allows us to get our message across faster, and being able to really have that message stand out through pauses, through enunciation and changes in tone. And especially, I feel like I have a tendency to speed up whenever I'm talking about something that I'm passionate about, or when I'm nervous, I will definitely speed up a lot. And being able to pace yourself is so important. Take a deep breath in, take a deep breath out. And the more the non-technical, I guess, aspect is circling back to my point about storytelling. My first draft of my TED Talk just had statistics and numbers. And yeah, while these numbers are certainly insightful and relevant, I think it's also important, like you said, to put a face to these statistics, because each number represents a population, each number represents a person. So being able to insert myself more, insert stories more, insert my background more is really, really valuable. There's kind of a tendency to think that, wow, like I can't really do this, or like when I do get it, I'm kind of intimidated because TED is such a, I feel like it's a, it's been, TED and TEDx have been held at such high regard, and being able to feel like it, like feeling like an imposter almost going into it. And even, you know, during my presentation, presenting in front of, I think, like around 200 people, I felt like an imposter. And I think I know that everyone talks about imposter syndrome, and I think that it's so often used. But yeah, I did feel like an imposter. But being able to connect with people after the presentation, people, you know, coming up to me and being like, wow, I really enjoyed your talk, and, you know, I want to join Valentia, or like, I want to be able to help out in my community. I think erasing that, that like imposter syndrome, and being like, yeah, I do belong here, I do have something to say, is important. And I think definitely don't doubt yourself, I think, is one piece of advice that I wish someone told me. I doubt myself all the time. And being able to have that reassurance that the audience is definitely going to be supportive, the audience wants to know what you have to say, and you definitely are there for a reason.
And that wraps it up for our interview with Linda for today. I hope all of you were able to glean some encouragement and insight from learning about her story. After the break, we'll be chatting with a representative from the Trans Coalition, one who has chosen to remain anonymous for this interview, about what they think are the most important reasons for student voters to vote yes for the referenda item that seeks to include gender-affirming care into the AMS health and dental plan, and why they think that doing so can help save trans students' lives.
Organize UBC wants to unionize student workers. Are you a research assistant, an academic assistant, or a work learn? For far too long, student workers have endured low wages, no job protection, and poor working conditions. Organize UBC is fighting back, and all they ask is for student workers to sign a card on their website so the union becomes certified. To sign a card and to find out more information, go to organizeubc.cupe.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9. Broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Just a few words before I go to sleep. I feel like I'm gonna dream tonight. Big bad ones, you know? The kind you like.
There is a lot of music out there, but only some is strange enough for you. My name is B, and on SlimeWire, I do the work for you, picking out freaky tunes to rule your nighttime world. So check it out. Every Wednesday at 10 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to CITR's weekly news radio show, Against the Current. For our final segment for today's episode, we'll be speaking to a representative from the Trans Coalition at UBC about why they think that student voters should vote yes to the referenda item asking to expand the AMS health and dental plan to include gender-affirming care for trans students.
The Trans Coalition started out as an initiative of the Pride Collective. This work that So the Trans Coalition was founded as an initiative of the Pride Collective and also by volunteers from the Pride Collective's Gender Empowerment Store to tackle a lot of the issues that trans people are facing accessing healthcare right now. So trans students at UBC advocating for things like coverage for gender-affirming care and for better standards of care at UBC accessing healthcare.
Can you tell me a bit more about what the struggles that trans students at UBC are facing in terms of accessing gender-affirming care?
Yeah, definitely. So I think that it's sort of two-pronged question in the UBC context. Outside of the UBC context, there are so many social, societal, political, financial, family barriers that trans people, especially trans youth, encounter accessing care, and really across the board in Canada, in other provinces, and in BC, trans youth just generally struggle to even get in the door to have an appointment. In some provinces right now, those wait times to be seen just to get a prescription for HRT. And this is like really not complicated care to provide. This care is provided by general practitioners. It's provided by nurse practitioners. It does not need to be provided by like a specialist endocrinologist. And the wait lists, just going through the trans referral program from TransCare BC in the Vancouver Coastal Health area. That wait list, I believe, the estimated wait right now is something like 6 to 8 months. And 6 to 8 months is too long, especially when trans people essentially are going to their existing family physicians, their existing doctors that they have or that they have had, especially trans youth. And those doctors are saying, no, I don't feel comfortable providing this care, so I'm going to refer you out. And then that trans person has to wait just to start, essentially. And that's really unacceptable.
Our anonymous source also shared that in their experience, when trying to book an appointment with a registered nurse practitioner to access gender-affirming care at Orchard Commons, on the website, there would only be one nurse practitioner who is qualified to treat trans students in that area of care, and that they have heard similar experiences being shared by other trans students in the UBC community.
UBC students and UBC trans students deserve better from the health services that are provided by the university. So that's one big component of our advocacy that we're, that's one big component of our advocacy that we're working on. But again, it's not the one that has been, I suppose, in the sort of like in as much public consciousness right now, or consciousness at UBC, and that would be our health insurance. So that being the thing that is happening now. Right now, we're really in a crisis of access to gender-affirming healthcare. The coverage that we have from the province of BC is quite limited. And there are so many procedures, treatment services that are not covered by the province that people really do need access to. There are treatments that are required for you to have to access covered procedures, and those treatments are not covered. So what we have from the province, is inadequate to many trans students' needs, trans people's needs. Essentially, you wait so long just to get in the door. And then once you get in the door, you find out you can't afford the care that you need because it's not covered. And out of pocket, so many of these are just wholly inaccessible due to their cost. So right now, UBC Trans Coalition, and for the past several months, we were working with the AMS to bridge that gap by making gender-affirming coverage accessible through our student care plan.
So I know that the Trans Coalition is advocating for better coverage. Can you tell me more about what better coverage in terms of expanding the coverage for gender-affirming care for trans students looks like in terms of the AMS health and dental plan, please?
Yeah, for sure. So the coverage that we are hopefully adding, and of course it's dependent on this vote, will provide coverage for gender-affirming care that's not currently offered and covered by the province. So anything that's currently quote-unquote like private pay or out of pocket, those things would be included. The coverage does not include pharmaceutical care coverage. We tried very hard to have that be a part of this in this round, but that will be a sort of ongoing advocacy effort to expand the pharmaceutical and drug coverage under the plan. But this coverage that's on the line with this vote will directly improve so many trans students' lives and their well-being and their health. This coverage will be life-saving. This coverage that will be added if this vote passes will make a profound difference for trans students' lives and their well-being. It will also be hopefully precedent setting for universities in Canada, and also a message to the province that this needs to change and this needs to improve, because right now what's covered and what's not covered, the things that are not covered, there's no reason for them not to be by the province. We've been, having to struggle as organizers to bring this coverage through our student union. But that's really not the way that it should be. It is that way, so this vote needs to pass, but it shouldn't be that way. The province should be providing comprehensive gender-affirming healthcare, and right now they're not. And they're doing better than other provinces, but they're still leaving serious gaps for a lot of people. And those gaps in coverage are really harmful. There's no defined gender-affirming coverage in the student care plan. So the student care plan does not serve as any supplement to the coverage from the province. There are many health insurance plans in Canada, which have, through the private system, they've expanded coverage to include a lot of those things that the province doesn't cover. So, if you are employed and you have a union and your union provides healthcare benefits, it's possible or even likely in some cases that you'll have expanded, employee healthcare benefits from your work, from your union. But from our student union, we don't have any. And I think it's important to stress also that, trans students and trans youth who are coming out of high school and coming to university are not likely to be in a position where they can pay for these things out of pocket, and they're not likely to be in a position where they have a job that provides those benefits. This is basic healthcare. Gender affirming healthcare is healthcare. And the fact that it's excluded from our student care plan, and it has been for so long, that trans students have been going without this coverage, is really unacceptable.
I know you've mentioned several times that when trans students and trans youth especially are not able to access gender-affirming care, it can really jeopardize their health. Can you explain to me a couple of the ways in which it is detrimental to trans health to not be able to access this kind of care?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's really important to note that trans people, at a population level across the board, we experience worse overall health than the general population. Trans people are by orders of magnitude have a higher likelihood of having an unmet healthcare need from the general population. Sorry, I'm just gonna, okay, we're gonna start again. So the reasons why for trans people, it's detrimental. So I think it's really important to note that trans people at a population level, we're underrepresented and we're underserved in our healthcare system, and at a population level for reasons that extend beyond just access to healthcare. We have higher all-cause mortality, higher rates of suicidality, and altogether worse health outcomes among the trans population. And we also know from studies upon studies that access to gender-affirming healthcare directly improves those outcomes, and access to gender-affirming healthcare saves lives. Another component of that is that access to gender-affirming healthcare promptly directly improves those outcomes, especially for trans youth. And those are really critical times in people's lives where, they need to have access to this care, because not having access to it, among trans youth, the rates of suicidality are quite high. And a lot of the time that's being in unsupportive family environments, But it's also being in environments where the wait lists are just unacceptable for trans youth. There are trans youth who go on wait lists to receive gender-affirming healthcare as youth. They age out of those wait lists, and then they cannot be on those wait lists anymore, and they have to go on to a wait list for adults. That is not okay. Trans people deserve so much better. And those ways in which we are underserved by our healthcare system, it's really important that people vote yes to all the referenda. Vote yes to save the student care plan, to save our mental health coverage, which is also on the line in this referendum cycle, and to vote yes for gender affirming healthcare, life saving gender affirming healthcare. It's a really critical time to be showing allyship, and it's a really critical moment where we could bring material support to a population who really need that support. This is an opportunity for people to do the right thing. Healthcare is so important. So many people need the healthcare benefits that are currently on the line, and our mental health care benefits. And so many people need to have gender-affirming healthcare. This is life-saving coverage. And I think it's important that people understand that. They go to ubcvote.ca and they vote yes.
And that wraps it up for today's episode, everyone. I hope that all of you were able to learn something from all four of our guest speakers for today, and that the UBC students who are listening to this are making sure to go online and go vote, not only for your AMS elected representatives, but also for the very important, very critical referenda items this year.
Thank you. It's great. It's too much for a cultural backwater like Vancouver. It just bursts with violence. It's got every absurdity and nihilism of the world.
CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Vancouver. Every absurdity and nihilism of the world since 1937.
It'll play off Broadway. I can see it now.
Welcome to Techno Progressivo. I'm DJ Waugh, and you're listening to 101.9 CITR here in Vancouver. I'm proud to work and live on the unceded territories of the Musqueam.